This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Witchcraft starts happening when our bodies come right up to the edge of their sensory and linguistic abilities, and life keeps going anyway.
When I look out my window, many sights to see.
It happens when we realise that we cannot truly describe the way flowers smelled one night on our holiday, but that we can hold the scent inside us, can conjure it back. When we try to describe the way geranium petals hold the light of the day inside them until the last second of dusk, seem somehow lambent in their redness, as if they could, single-handed, stop the night from happening. And we realise that we can't.
Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch, yeah. Must be the season of the witch.
Hello and thank you for downloading this podcast. I'm Ewan McElraith. I work across radio and television, and the bulk of my reporting involves nature, wildlife, our landscape. And that's inevitably led me to being intrigued by witches and the magic. I'm looking at my bookshelf at the moment, and I've got a copy of Festivals of Scotland by Mary McNeil, a piece on the witches' craft. Scotland and witchcraft go hand in hand, and as we approach Halloween, it's really quite appropriate. And our guest today is going to enlighten us a bit more on that. But before that, my companion on this edition of the podcast is Helen Needham.
Hello. Well, I've been thinking about this a lot because we often talk about magic when we're describing the natural world on this podcast, when we see the way the light hits water or a fabulous sunset or the wind blowing in the trees. And we revel in observing these moments, but we don't actually often stop to consider what magic actually is.
Well, Alice Tarbuck is with us and she's going to help us out in this one. Alice is an academic and also describes herself as an urban witch. And she's just published a new book called A Spell in the Wild, A Year and Six Centuries of Magic. Alice, hello.
Hello, it's lovely to be joining you today.
Well, we're both really looking forward to it. Where are you at the moment? I'm in northeast of Scotland in Bamshire. Usually we do this programme outside, but it is lashing rain, so I've come inside beside the fire. Where are you?
I'm in Edinburgh at the moment, where it is grey and steely, but it has not yet given in to rain.
But it is a magical time of year. We'll probably use this word so many times over the next half an hour or so. You know, the trees are just beautiful. And I've met quite a few witches in my time. One of the first reports I ever did for the BBC, and I can't remember why, I was sitting naked with a witch in the southwest of Scotland with my feet in a pit that she'd dug. And I really can't remember why. I've been to a sabbat on Arran, which was absolutely fantastic. I even bought a couple of spells to help my children pass their driving test. They did pass. Did the spell work? I don't know. But you define yourself as a witch. I mean, what is a witch? How did it come about?
There are as many ways of doing witchcraft as there are witches. And I'm very sad that today we cannot be sitting naked in any sort of pit. I feel I've really let you down.
I think you got off lightly, actually.
For me, witchcraft has always been born of and kind of connected to a practice of trying to connect to landscape really holistically. So kind of allowing yourself not just to admire landscape as a kind of hierarchically placed observer, but really sort of participate in it as kind of the same, having the same qualities of participation as a mushroom or a squirrel or a tree. And I think for me, I definitely come from a tradition of very practical and very private witchcraft. I have a lot of people in my life who brought me up who certainly wouldn't describe themselves as witches, but just like you say, for your children, when I was born, my parents, who are not normally particularly witchily inclined, invited a white wizard to plant a tree for me and bless me in our garden. And so I've always grown up with a kind of pervasive sense of doing sort of practical magic in the house. So, you know, coming up to Halloween or Samhain, we will carve turnip lanterns probably, and we will put candles in all of our windows as we always do on solstices. So for me, that was just very normal, the way other people go to brownies or Sunday school. So I think it's always been with me. And then as I got older, it's evolved into a more formalized practice as I learned more about it.
When you talk about witchcraft, what exactly do you mean? What does it mean for you? Because a lot of people will have their own perception of witchcraft, and sometimes that might be quite a negative thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have had a lot of people who, in the course of releasing this book, have looked at me slightly askance when I've told them what it's about. The poor sound engineer, when I recorded the audiobook, looked terrified of me until he heard the book, and then he calmed down a bit. So witchcraft for me is a mixture of folk practices, honouring traditions that have been around in Scotland and Britain for a really long time. It is also a kind of private spiritual practice of worship, so it has more in common there with maybe Wicca or paganism. Some witches only practice witchcraft when they have spells to do, and I think that that's fine. But for me, it's a kind of practice of connecting to nature through meditation, through time spent at, I have a little altar inside. It's a practice that informs my way of being in the world. And of course also involves doing spells, because that's what witches do. The edges of language are sharp and pervert our meanings sideways. What the edges tell us, if we listen to them, is that there are experiences we can have that we cannot talk about using normal means, or at least not satisfactorily. These are experiences not just of our single personhood, but also of relation. They are experiences of the world, in the world. They are experiences where flowers reach their light right into our eyes. They are experiences where we feel as if we are full of holes, as if the world can come not only close against us, but can actually enter right into us, so that we are as shot through with it as if we were Saint Sebastian and the world was arrows.
We nail this on the head. A lot of people immediately say witch, they say, oh, devil worshippers. My understanding, and you'll correct me, it's got nothing to do with the devil at all.
Witches have always been this category, historically, of women and men who voluntarily entered into deals with the devil, often in the case of women, that involved sleeping with the devil, and became conduits for satanic power. So one of the kind of definitions of witchcraft historically is people who have no inherent power themselves in the occult sort of definition, but who become willing vessels to work the devil's will. Now, that absolutely is not how witches are defined today. I feel very confident in saying I have no belief in the devil and no relationship with the idea of the devil, although that won't be true of all witches, of course. But what's happened is we've lost a lot of those historical definitions. So when Alfred the Great in 809 gives this edict against witchcraft, he includes a lot of subcategories who are okay. So spirit healers, people who sing incantations, people who do herbal medicine are all better than witches. And then in the medieval period, you've got cunning men and women. In Cornwall, they were called pellers, which is short for expellers, people who got out bad spirits. So you've had all of these very important definitions sociologically and culturally, historically, but we've sort of lost those. And since the repeal of the Witchcraft Act in the 1950s, it's been a word that has come to mean anyone who's got any involvement in the occult, and it's become a much more acceptable word. The world demonstrates, occasionally, that it isn't just connected to us, isn't a network in which we are one distant, autonomous node. Rather, it is us. We are then overpowered by it, entered by it, and transformed. And in the same way, we enter the world daily and transform it, for better or for worse. Every time we act, every time we think, even, we are shaping the world and it is shaping us, and there is no escape from either. Understanding those encounters is the job of witchcraft. Learning how to enter into them, how to court them, how to cause them, that is magic.
When I look out my window, what do you think I see? And when I look in my window, so many different people to be. It's strange.
There's that long history of witchcraft in Scotland. You say in your book there were 6,000 men and women, mainly women, executed. It's a big subject, I know, but who were these people? Were they outcasts? You know, why was society so against them?
There is an amazing tool which you can use online, which Edinburgh University have produced, which is an interactive map of all of the Scottish witch trials. You can click on where they are and you can drill down and access the source information of exactly who these people were, what they were put on trial for, and often what their material circumstances were, what their professions were, who they were married to. These people were very, very ordinary people. They were, as you say, mostly women. About three quarters of all accused witches were women. There's a myth that pervades that they were kind of healers and midwives. And although some of them were, the vast majority of them weren't. They were as diverse as any cross-section of the population. They were wives and mothers, they were widows, they were owners of land, they were poor people. In Scotland, for example, James VI and I, whose position as a ruler of the United Kingdom and as a Protestant was quite unstable, because of course he'd had a Catholic mother and there were lots of plots to get rid of him. He was one of the kind of main proponents in Scotland of drumming up all this witchcraft hysteria, because he was terrified that people were going to try and unthrone him using kind of occult and heretical means. So what this turned into was a kind of conflation between heretical acts that went against the community, and witchcraft. And what it became was a really useful tool for essentially getting rid of or daubing in your troublesome neighbour. So if you've got a widow who lives next to you who inherited a farm and you want to put a fence halfway across her field and she's not having it, a really easy way to get rid of that problem is to accuse her of making one of your cattle ill through satanic and occult means. But you also have to remember that this is a time where the devil, who has been largely ignored since the medieval period, is kind of resurrected as a very real figure who can walk among people, and often in Scotland and other Protestant European countries, conflated with papism, with Catholicism, with the Pope even. So the devil is as much a fact of life as cows or taxes. So it's a really complicated picture of misogyny, of social control, of religious anxiety, of anxiety about how communities look and who is welcome in them. And so really the victims of the witch trials are a hugely diverse set of people who have very little to connect them except the fact that they were accused of witchcraft.
Alice, one of the things that really struck me when I was reading your book is your inclination towards gathering from the natural world. And I took a look around my house and thought, oh, I do this too. I've got an acorn here that I picked yesterday. I've got bird feathers everywhere. I've got conkers and shells and stones. I just seem to gather stuff. Explain the significance of objects and the collecting of them within your approach.
One of the most fascinating things has been people sending me messages on social media saying, oh my God, I do that too. I have a nature table. I am forever having pockets full of sea glass and conkers. And I think it's a very human instinct. We like gathering things. We like foraging. We like cultivating food and trees, but we also just like finding interesting things in the natural world. We're a lot more similar to magpies than people would have us believe, I think. So for me, basically, there is this understanding which I draw largely from, a range of sources, kind of academic and social and practical, but Sabrina Scott's beautiful book, Witch Body, has had a real effect on my practice. So I have to give her credit. And it takes phenomenological theory, which I know sounds very highfalutin, but it takes these theories of how we interpret objects and how objects relate to us and moves them into the kind of the occult realm. So essentially there's this idea that magic has never worked alone. And it's very much this idea that all objects have, for risk of sounding too hippie, have a kind of energy or a presence. Objects don't just exist in their space, they also occupy a certain kind of space around themselves. The world isn't full of space, it's full of relationships between objects, if you like. And by gathering interesting objects, especially from the natural world, and kind of drawing them into relationship with us, so arranging them in our house, putting them on an altar, using them for things, what we're really doing there is kind of networking with these objects, developing relationships with them, and with the world by extension where they come from. And so for me, the collection of symbolic or practical objects is a fundamental part of how witchcraft works. We gain power and we gain energy from caring for the world. And we often do that care that often starts with noticing and collecting objects that you then might arrange in a beautiful way in your home. And then you've got this kind of relationship with them. And for me, that helps draw into relation the whole big wide world and get the energy that you need to do workings that you can then send out. So it's about an attention and an ethics of care for the environment that starts with often tuning into the world in a way that makes these objects reveal themselves to you, really paying attention to them.
And then there's also the thing about gathering food, foraging as well, and turning that into something. You write really beautifully, actually, about that, about the ritual of making jam or whatever, and taking it in.
Yes, and I think that these are things, again, that we do instinctually, and also things that we have now that most of us don't have to forage for our food in a way that provides or does not provide sustenance. We are able to do it much more as a hobby, but that also means that we've lost some of our engagement with it, which is, you know, a neutral thing. I'm not somebody who desperately wants everyone to go back to old ways of any kind. But there is something really important and seasonal, I think, for me about, for example, picking raspberries and making raspberry jam. And so in February, you can open that bottle, that jar, and eat something that tastes of the summer day that you gathered the raspberries and tastes of the long evening you spent waiting for the jam to set and wishing you could go to bed because you've forgotten how long jam takes. And that is a really important part, I think, of living with the world, engaging seasonally with it. Remembering that, you know, if you buy fresh raspberries in February, they've come from a really, really long way away. And perhaps an alternative is to have preserved ones that came to you locally and seasonally and then be eating them at another time. And I think it's a good way for me of kind of emotionally navigating the year because it means that spring becomes this very exciting time, not only because everything's growing, but because there's wild garlic coming through and nettles coming through. And, you know, you're back to being able to pick greens from the land around you, which has been so lifeless and so dark for so many months, especially in Scotland. There's a lovely recipe for something called nettle kale, which is a nettle soup, which is important in Scotland because it's one of the first recipes that you could make with fresh greens, because nettles grow again quite early in the year. And so for me, it's kind of an important part of understanding the world as a cycle. And one of the things in our increasingly kind of non-religious society or kind of non-Christian society is that one of the things that Christianity does is it gives you a liturgical year that really ties in with the seasons. So lots of people did a harvest festival at school, and you have the bringer of the light, Jesus being born at Christmas. And so as we move away from that, we can kind of see the turns of the year that informed the liturgical calendar and get back to celebrating those. And I think one of the best ways that humans know how to celebrate is through food, honestly, through making food and sharing food. And so if you can also have gathered food from the land, in whatever small way that is, that's a really rewarding thing, I think.
I'm looking out at my tree beside me at the moment, and there's still some apples left on it. And I was crushing apples last weekend with my granddaughter, and the look of amazement that she had when you crushed the apples and this beautiful pink juice emerged, and she drunk it and it was sweet, and it was just such an enlightening moment. And you kind of normally associate apples with Halloween and Samhain, the kind of Celtic celebration. It's a time when we're allegedly closer to the dead. Can you give us a bit of background on the festival and what it means?
The festival of Samhain, or Halloween, is also coincides with All Hallows' Eve, the Christian celebration of the solemn remembrance of the dead. So it's a time when across cultures, people move to remember their dead. And one of the things I think that we are quite bad at in contemporary Britain is relating to those who have gone before us in a kind of practical way. There's a lot of taboos around visible grief, I think, these days, and we don't perhaps make formalised time to remember those who have gone before us. And I think that this year, especially in this really difficult year, having some time to think about people that we've lost and people who came before us and lived through similar difficult times becomes really important. And All Hallows' Eve, or Halloween, or Samhain, is a very Celtic festival. It has its roots in the dark north, and Scotland certainly thinks that it invented it. I think we're quite good at celebrating the move into the dark and at thinking about the way that the veil might thin. And this idea of the veil thinning is basically to do with reaching an increase in darkness, an increase in kind of difficulty of operating in the daylight, and the idea that in the dark things become much more strange. Samhain has a lot of really fabulous celebrations. You mentioned apples, and one of the things that we do a lot traditionally is dooking for apples. And dooking for apples has this really interesting kind of history. We think that dooking comes from a Roman tradition. So the Romans brought apples to Britain, which I know is a strange thing to think, but we didn't always have them. And when they brought apples, they also brought their traditions around celebrating the apple harvest. And as you say, as we come up to Halloween, you're looking at the last of the apples from the tree. There's still apples on the tree, but we're getting to the time where you want them off and harvested and dealt with, because they're not going to be good much longer. So there was a Roman tradition that you would put the last of the harvest apples into a river, and unmarried, single young people would put their faces in the river and try and bite them. And if they did, it meant they would kind of, you know, make a match in the coming year. And I think that's a really lovely example of a way that tradition from one period in time and one set of observances has moved kind of seamlessly into being a folk tradition in Scotland.
You need fires as well, don't you?
Samhain is kind of the answer in the wheel of the year, so the pagan celebrations of the year, to Beltane. And in that they're both fire festivals, and Beltane welcomes in the light, and Samhain sees the light waning. And so there's a tradition in Ireland and in Scotland, which is now largely died out, of need fires at Samhain. So a need fire, or a force fire, is a fire that is kindled not through kind of general means, but specifically through friction. As in, you force the fire through rubbing rope against wood. It's not a fire that comes from another fire, which is how fires would usually have started, because it's hard to start a fire. So traditionally, fires would have been kept burning, and if your neighbour's fire went out, you would give them a peat full of embers and it would light their fire again. But need fires are a new fire. They're a fire that you have created through friction. They were usually created outdoors. They were big. And they were used to purify. So they were often used to drive cattle through the smoke to get rid of any diseases that they might have, which we now know is to do with some of the antiseptic qualities of smoke and things that were burned. But this was a very important ritual, and it was also a time when people would gather around the need fire and use it to ward off evil spirits. And it's interesting because, of course, Bonfire Night has very different cultural roots. But it's interesting to me that at this time of year, we have a very strong need to kindle light, to fight the darkness with these big fires, or even with candles or fairy lights in our own homes. And that seems to me to tie in with lots and lots of other festivals of light that take place across the world at similar times of darkness in whatever hemisphere you're in.
I'm definitely going to do a need fire this Halloween, because I also noticed from the book you said that ideally they should be performed on an island in a river.
Yes.
And I just so happen to live by a river that has an island. So I'm like, I'm gearing up for this.
Oh, that's so magic. Oh, that's brilliant.
The other thing, of course, that is widely associated with Halloween these days is what the Americans call trick-or-treating, but what we here in Scotland call guising. What are the origins of guising?
Guising is really, really ancient. It's part of traditions that you see all across Britain and Ireland and the Isle of Man, which are called mumming or souling traditions, or traditions of animal disguise. And basically what this is people going from door to door offering blessings, usually, or safekeeping in exchange for welcome. So one of the traditions that we see this really strongly in is the Welsh tradition of the Mary Lwyd, and I'm very sorry to any Welsh speakers, I've probably murdered that, which is when a horse skull operated on a stick by a man dressed usually in a blanket or in another way disguised, goes from door to door, and the people who move with it sing, and they have to be invited in and given welcome. And if they are invited in and given welcome, then that house is given good luck for the year. We see this as well in the Scottish Hogmanay tradition of first footing. And it's very important that you greet a first footer and welcome them in. The same is true traditionally of guising, which is kind of a corruption of the word disguise, which is exactly the same. It operates from the same tradition of strangers visiting a house and essentially making a magic spell. There's a contract that happens between the person visiting and the person opening the door that means that both parties are given good luck. So rather than trick or treating, guising is when you come to the house in disguise and you do a turn, you perform something, you say a rhyme or you say a poem. And that comes from this idea that you offer a kind of formalised, ritualised formula that offers good luck if the person accepts it. If they either invite you in or nowadays give you a sweet or a penny or an orange or whatever it is, but there's an exchange. You give them your words and they give you a token to show that they have heard and accepted. They are offering you hospitality, the same as inviting the Mary Lou into your house or the tall, dark stranger. And I think it's really important to remember the roots of that,
because it means that guising stops being about just kind of wanting sweets from your neighbours and becomes actually a way in which we do folk magic. We go around to each other's houses and we offer something in exchange for something, and that moment of exchange creates magic that helps get rid of the spirits, any evil spirits, and offers luck to the house for the year. And the reason that people traditionally went in disguise, the same reason for the Mary Lou and her terrifying skeletal appearance, is so that evil spirits who walked abroad at Samhain couldn't recognise people and trick them. So it's a very kind of complicated and rich tradition, and it's one that I'm really glad seems to be making a bit of a comeback.
You touched on it before about neepy lanterns, which has been hijacked by pumpkins. What's the point of that?
Turnip lanterns, neepy lanterns, jack-o'-lanterns are the predecessor, if you like, of the pumpkin. Pumpkins are much easier to carve. Anyone who's ever tried to carve a turnip will know that it is a largely extremely unrewarding endeavour that involves breaking spoons and parents watching you use a knife with increasing disbelief. But the origins of it are really interesting. So jack-o'-lanterns or neepy lanterns share a kind of common etymology with other spirit lights, if you like. So will-o'-the-wisps, which are sometimes also called jack-o'-lanterns, which are the strange lights that appear over marshes to mislead walkers, or jack-of-the-lantern, who is an Irish mythological figure who made a deal with the devil to make sure he would never go to hell. But then when he died, he didn't get into heaven either because he hadn't been very good. So there was nowhere he could go. And so he was forced to walk the world eternally. And in order to show himself to be a kind of denizen of the underworld, he had a lantern made of a turnip with a hot burning coal from hell inside it. And he was seen as a kind of trickster figure, not a very nice figure, certainly not someone that you would want to meet. But what often happens in magic practice and folklore is that we take the things that scare us and we use them to ward them off, if you see what I mean, which is an example of apotropaic magic, so magic which is done against evil. So we've taken the scary appearance of the turnip lantern or the pumpkin lantern, and we carve them to look as terrifying as we can, and we put them outside our homes. And what that is to do is to say, look, we already have these terrifying spirits on our walls, so all the bad spirits, you can just walk past, because we've already got something much scarier. And it's that way that we often do of we take images of things that frighten us and we make them our own so that we can use them to frighten off something that might be worse.
I'm a big fan of folklore, and you describe the Calic or the crone and its association with Samhain. You tell us a bit about the crone.
Yes, of course. And so there's a little bit of my book that touches on it, if you would like me to read it.
Yes, please.
The Calic lives with her husband and seven children, though the number varies, in a little cottage right up at the top of Glen Lyon in Perthshire, just as any other respectable crofter might. Like that of the rest of the Glen's 100 or so inhabitants, the Calic's roof needs turfed every few years, the sides of her house shored up against damage. In the summer months, she sits outside her home, blessing the bright green wildness of that place, ensuring that the farmland stays fertile. She and her family soak up the soft summer rain and the low, sweet winds and gaze down the glen toward the silver of the river. In the winter months, they retire indoors from where the Calic emerges in spirit to wreak the havoc of winter onto the world. They are, all in all, a very ordinary family, except, perhaps, that they are made of stone. For the Calic, who lives at Tyne and Boddock, or the House of the Old Man or Ghost, is part, archaeologists and folklorists believe, of an ancient pre-Christian system of idol worship. Her wee house, hidden away up the glen, may be the oldest site of continuous pre-Christian worship in Europe. She is looked after, and has been for hundreds of years, by the community she dwells in. Until his death, head stalker Bob Bissett of the Invermeernan Estate,
on whose land she lives, maintained the stones. They are still tended, though we do not know by whom. People are not in the habit of disclosing such things. The ceremonies of inviting her out of her house and putting her back in are deeply private, and this respect, this continuous worship, gives us a sense of her being at home in Glenlyon.
Well, talking of winter, I was really cheered by your attention to winter and December in particular in your book. There's obviously the winter solstice, there's Yule and Christmas to consider, but you actually offer some practical advice on how to embrace the darkness, which we are approaching now. Can you share some of that practical advice? Because a lot of people do struggle, actually, in winter.
A lot of people struggle, and I think it's going to be a particularly difficult winter this year for a lot of people, for obvious reasons. And one of the things that I think the solstice offers us, and that the kind of the growing darkness offers us, is in witchcraft practice, it's often considered a time not to do external work in the world, but to kind of look inwards and do internal work, which partly, of course, involves thinking about things you might want to leave behind in the year that's gone, but also involves really attending to your needs, seeing how the world can receive you in this time of darkness when we don't have a lot of energy, we don't have a lot of reserves, and we're still asked to get up in the dark and go to bed in the dark. And there's also this idea that the solstice, which is the 21st of December, marks the darkest day of the year, the least light. Now, that's much earlier than I think most of us think. And that's because partly the way that the clocks work, but partly because you then only gain a minute of brightness every day up to the spring equinox. So paying attention, if you can, to the tiny increments of light that come, however meagre, is a really important thing, I think. And one of the things that I always do for Yule rather than for Christmas is try and bring in some evergreens, so some clippings of holly, some bits of ivy that you can find around the place, just to make sure that there is something green in your house. Now, I live in a flat and I don't usually get a big Christmas tree because I'm not, in a typical year, I don't spend Christmas in my flat, I go to family. So I don't have a Christmas tree, but one of the things I love to do is get clippings of Christmas trees from Christmas tree salespeople who start very early in December. And often they're the bottom branches that nobody wants because they can't get them into their car. And just having the smell, that Christmassy smell, that wintry smell in my house kind of fulfills the function of a whole Christmas tree. The other thing that I do, which I would not recommend to everybody, is go in the sea in December. Not my whole body usually, but just a paddle. Just get in that really cold water and feel alive. And I should make a disclaimer that if you have any health conditions, obviously that's not for you. Please don't have a heart attack in the sea. But it's a lovely, lovely way of actually going out and embracing the winter rather than hiding from it, which I'm so tempted to do behind double glazing and under duvets.
Every year, you're talking about Christmas trees. I take the Christmas tree and keep it, and I cut it up into logs just on the run-up to Christmas and light the first fire of Christmas with the old Christmas tree from a year gone by. And it just gives you a real sense of connection. There's something really special about it. But if I'm going to fairies, Scottish fairies are a very different beast from perhaps a fairy south of the border. But you had an encounter in the woods. Can you read that to us?
Yes, of course. I'm very interested in the regional variations of fairies. And here is something that happened to me, which I still cannot explain. Two grey figures stand in the trees. They are tall, taller than me, perhaps close to 6 feet. They are wearing cloaks of some kind, and from underneath the grey comes a flash of green. Their faces are half hidden by hoods, and I cannot make out their features. Their hands are by their sides, and their feet are on the ground, exactly as you would imagine. They weren't there, but now they are. I was alone, and now I am not. They are standing behind me, deeper into the forest, and yet I can see them, ahead of me. They're easy to perceive. They're easy to feel, cool and stock still at my back. They aren't quite a man and a woman, but rather two matched and complementary forces, sighs breathed on different winds. Their faces are impassive, and no greeting is exchanged. A meeting on neutral territory, the edge of mine, the edge of theirs. They bring no message, give me no particular wisdom. They aren't comforting. All they are is present. They are waiting for me to join them in the forest, to push further in until I'm walking into deep shadow. A strong pull, a strong desire to slip a hand into theirs, to roam into the grey-green dark. On that first visit, I don't. I write a little word on a bit of bark and leave it on the ground for long enough that I can feel they've seen it. The word is, perhaps. That is all the answer I can give them. They do not nod their heads, merely acknowledge what has passed between us in a way that I can feel, like a shadow passing over a patch of sunlit grass, and disappear. They neither walk away nor fly, neither fade nor pass me. As they arrived, so they leave.
I've had a similar experience to that, actually. I saw a cloaked figure when I was probably about 18 or 19, and a friend of mine was with me and saw it as well. And the way that you describe it was exactly the way there was just no... It was just there, and then it just disappeared. And I thought it was a ghost, but could it have been a fairy?
I have this sort of ongoing theory that the way that we perceive landscape, because we are humans and we like things with faces, is landscape or forces that we cannot reckon with that are abstract often come to us wearing faces. So Calach is the face of winter. Fairies are the face of the places they are in. And often if we're tuned into those places, we see things with faces. We see an anthropomorphized version of that place because it's the easiest way that it can communicate with us, and it's what we conjure. So for me, fairies are a way of understanding place, and I absolutely think that you are not the first person to say to me that they've had a very, very similar encounter, that there was a hooded figure who was there and then gone. And I absolutely think that they are what we would understand as fae folk, fairies, the gentry, as they're often referred to, or the lords and ladies, respectfully. And they appear and they disappear. And people who have never seen them will think that you and I are mad and are making it up. And people who have seen them will know exactly what we mean. And the way that I've always been taught to deal with the fae, to have dealings with the fae, is to be extremely polite and extremely deferential and not ask anything. And there's a section in my book where I talk about leaving cream out on a fairy hill in Argyll, because that's what you do. You give them something and you don't ask anything in return, and in exchange you all go on politely ignoring each other. And I think that that is one of the differences between Scottish fae and fairies south of the border, is that ours never got smaller in the popular imagination. They are people-sized and very grave and very complicated and very other from us. And however we understand them, as manifestations of place or as people or as spirits, the best thing to do is nod politely and not make any bargains, I think.
You talk about place there, and that's something that I'm really interested in, is that there are definitely some places which as individuals we're drawn to that we find special. We find some kind of magic, as it were. There's a place that I go to a lot near where I live where there's a gnarly oak in the middle of a grove of trees, but it could be anywhere. You talk about a place in Edinburgh which you describe as sacred to you, and it's a back lane. What is it about these places that brings us something, some kind of energy or force.
We all have places, whether we're dog walkers who have a particular park that we like, or commuters who always stop to look at a particular tree through the seasons, or get a really good feeling on a particular street in a city. We all have them, and I think it's because we are creatures like any other creatures that kind of exist on, you know, we run on energy, and it's the same energy the rest of the world runs on. And there are places where, for whatever reason, our energetic makeup and the energetic makeup of that place call to us. And it might be a place where something significant has happened, but it might not be. And I think the lane, which is near my parents' house, is fascinating, because on one side there is a crematorium, and on the other side there are lots and lots of back gardens of houses and flats. What it feels like to me, what it's always felt like ever since I was really wee, is a sort of dividing point between the living and the dead. On one side of the wall are all the sleeping dead, and on the other side is all of life. And so that lane occupies this really fascinating kind of middle space, this kind of divide. And it's always felt really alive, really fizzy, if you like, is the best way I can think of describing it. It's not... Some of the places that are special to me are deeply peaceful. They're places I can go and really reflect and feel the deep peace of something, often old trees. But the lane is not like that. The lane is very busy, in whatever way you might want to describe or characterise that. And it feels very magical. It's very ugly. Like, I cannot stress to you enough that it is a back lane full of wheelie bins and where people let their dogs do their business, which they shouldn't. And, you know, I've found needles there. I've found used condoms there. I once surprised a drunk man who'd passed out there because I was walking down to get the bus to school. It's not a particularly aesthetic place. It's certainly not a place you'd go. But because I had to use it, it was a shortcut to the bus stop, because I used it all the time, I really, really came to feel it very closely and to appreciate it very closely. And I think that's one of the other ways that places become magical, because they are places we interact with all the time, and we build up a kind of patina or a kind of textured layer of interaction with those places.
What do you say to people, and there will be people listening to this, they think, all this talk of magic and witches and spells, it's just a load of nonsense.
Absolutely. And it might be. But there's a lovely quote. There's a theorist called Isabel Stengers, who wrote a really great book called Capitalist Magic, which is a kind of anti-capitalist theory. And one of the things she says in the book is, witches are not interested in whether or not something is true. They are interested in whether or not something works. And I am a great believer in that. There are things that work for people. There are things that we do that may or may not be true in a strict sense, but that have power and that effect change in the world. The rest of the quote is, she says, if when people say to witches, that's all just stories, witches say, but don't stories have power? And I think that's an important way of thinking about it. Witchcraft for me is a way of being in the world. It's an attitude of openness toward the world. Whether or not you or anyone else would think that the things that I do or believe have effect in the world, if I perceive them to, that is very helpful. There is a study that was done with people who have lucky objects, you know, like a hare's foot or something that's very personal to them, and they're allowed to take them into exams. And those people often do 10 to 20% better, simply because they've got something that they believe is helping them. Now, whether or not that hare's foot or that knitted doll from your granny that she always said was lucky is a magical object, the result of believing in it is incontrovertible. It's scientifically provable that it has a positive effect. And I feel like that about witchcraft. Whether or not you believe magic is real, whether or not you believe that I'm just going out into the woods and having a nice time and that's all that's happening, that having a nice time is still powerfully beneficial to me and also to the woods, because I go out and help look after them more, become a kind of better steward of the world that we have been given. And so I think for me, it is not about belief, it is about effect.
That's very interesting, because I find that I spend most of the year walking around with a conker in my jacket pocket. So quite often I'm kind of caressing this conker in various situations, and for some reason I find that works for me. We've talked a lot about the past and folklore, witches of the past. What about the contemporary role of witchcraft? Is there a growing movement? What's the situation around the world, and what kind of role is there for witchcraft?
Yeah, so interestingly, we see a resurgence in witchcraft and an interest in the occult after any major global recession or any major period of global instability. So there was a huge, for example, increase in people seeking spiritualists and mediums after the Second World War, for obvious reasons. People wanted to contact the many people that they had lost and take comfort in believing there were people who could contact them. So after the 2008 financial crash, culture saw a real uptick in witchcraft and interest in the occult. And that's because during periods where culturally we feel quite powerless, we harness whatever power we believe is accessible to us. So witchcraft and interest in witchcraft has kind of steadily been building for the past decade. And this happens. It is habitual. Soon enough, it will pass. And then it will be however many years, 20, 30, 50, until the next big resurgence. One of the things it's really important to kind of think about is the role of witchcraft in our contemporary ecological crisis, which is certainly a crisis that doesn't show any sign of abating anytime soon. Witchcraft has always been connected with ecological protest movements and an ethics of care for the environment, because if you are immersed in your environment and very attentive to it, you care very much on both a local and a global level that it is looked after. So I'm currently researching an academic book on the relationship between the occult and ecological preservation, which I'm really finding very rewarding. On one hand, there's looking after the planet, there's a kind of interest in ecological witchcraft, there is an interest in harnessing personal power as the world seems to swing from one crisis to another. There is also the idea of witchcraft as belonging to and empowering minority groups, and people who otherwise don't have their voices heard might feel that they can connect to each other and the world through occult means, because witchcraft has always been associated with marginalisation. There's also the fact that there are lots and lots of countries around the world where witchcraft is a condemnatory term given to pagan, in the broadest sense, non-Christian religious folk practices. And there are lots of countries where that remains illegal and in some places punishable by death. So there is still a kind of vital role of witches in countries where it is legal and broadly accepted to work towards global justice, really, and to protect people whose spiritual practices are under threat around the world. So witchcraft also has a role to play, I think, in global politics and social well-being.
Alice, we've only just scratched the surface on this. There's so much to think about, so much food for thought. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. And I also have a conker in my pocket, and I would recommend that everyone else goes out and finds one.
I have a conker in my jacket pocket as well. Alice Tarbuck's book, A Spell in the Wild, is out now. Please get in touch and tell us what you think about this podcast. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And if you enjoyed this, you might enjoy another podcast brought to you by BBC Radio Scotland.
Hi, Des Clark here. Just wanted to take a minute to tell you about Breaking the News. If you like the big headlines broken down by a panel of top comedians, we've got the podcast for you. With brand new episodes arriving every Friday afternoon, it's the funniest way to start your weekend. Just search for the Breaking the News podcast on BBC Sounds.
From myself, Ewan McElraith, Helen Needham, who's off to start a fire on an island, Alice Tarbuck, thanks very much for listening.